When the Sheriff Came in My Front Door by Homer Croy. The biggest moment of my life occurred one day in 1933, when the sheriff came in the front door and I went out the back. I'd lost my home at 10 Standish Road, Forest Hills, Long Island, where my children were born, and where I and my family had lived for 18 years. I'd never dreamed that this could happen to me. 12 years before, I thought I was sitting on top of the world. I'd sold the motion picture rights to my novel, West of the Water Tower, for a top Hollywood price. I lived abroad with my family for 2 years. We summered in Switzerland and wintered on the French Riviera, just like the idle rich. I spent 6 months in Paris and wrote a novel entitled They Had to See Paris. Will Rogers appeared in the screen version. It was his first talking picture. I had tempting offers to remain in Hollywood and write several of Will Rogers' pictures, but I didn't. I returned to New York, and my troubles began. It slowly dawned on me that I had great dormant abilities that I'd never developed. I began to fancy myself a shrewd businessman. Somebody told me that John Jacob Astor had made millions investing in vacant land in New York. Who was Astor? Just an immigrant peddler with an accent. If he could do it, why couldn't I? I was going to be rich. I began to read the yachting magazines. I had the courage of ignorance. I didn't know any more about buying and selling real estate than an Eskimo knows about oil furnaces. How was I to get the money to launch myself on my spectacular financial career? Oh, that was simple. I mortgaged my home and bought some of the finest building lots in Forest Hills. I was going to hold on to this land until it reached a fabulous price and then sell it and live in luxury. I, who had never sold a piece of real estate as big as a doll's handkerchief. I pitied the plodders who slaved in offices for a mere salary. I told myself that God had not seen fit to touch every man with the divine fire of financial genius. Suddenly, the Great Depression swept down upon me like a Kansas cyclone and shook me as a tornado would shake a hencoop. I had to pour $220 a month into that monster-mouthed piece of good earth. Oh, how fast those months came! In addition, I had to keep up the payments on our now mortgaged house and find enough food. I was worried. I tried to write humor for the magazines. My attempt at humor sounded like the Lamentations of Jeremiah. I was unable to sell anything. The novels I wrote failed. I ran out of money. I had nothing on which I could borrow money except my typewriter and the gold fillings in my teeth. The milk company stopped delivering milk. The gas company turned off the gas. We had to buy one of those little outdoor camp stoves you see advertised. It had a cylinder of gasoline. You pump it up by hand, and it shoots out a flame with a hissing like an angry goose. If we ran out of coal, the company sued us. Our only heat was the fireplace. I'd go out at night and pick up boards and leftovers from the new homes that the rich people were building. I, who had started out to be one of those rich people. I was so worried I couldn't sleep. I often got up in the middle of the night and walked for hours to exhaust myself so I could fall asleep. I lost not only the vacant land I had bought, but all my heart's blood that I had poured into it. The bank closed the mortgage on my home and put me and my family out on the street. In some way, we managed to get hold of a few dollars and rent a small apartment. We moved in the last day of 1933. I sat down on a packing case and looked around. An old saying of my mother's came back, "Don't cry over spilt milk." But this wasn't milk. This was my heart's blood. After I sat there a while, I said to myself, "Well, I've hit bottom, and I've stood it. There is no place to go now but up." I began to think of the fine things that the mortgage had not taken from me. I still had my health and my friends. I would start again. I would not grieve about the past. I would repeat to myself every day the words I had often heard my mother say about spilt milk. I put into my work the energy that I'd been putting into worrying. Little by little, my situation began to improve. I am almost thankful now that I had to go through all that misery. It gave me strength, fortitude, and confidence. I know now what it means to hit bottom. I know it doesn't kill you. I know we can stand more than we think we can. When little worries and anxieties and uncertainties try to disturb me now, I banish them by reminding myself of the time I sat down in the packing case and said, I've hit bottom and I've stood it. There is no place to go now but up. What's the principle here? Don't try to saw sawdust. Accept the inevitable. If you can't go lower, you can try going up. The Toughest Opponent I Ever Fought Was Worry, by Jack Dempsey. During my career in the ring, I found that Old Man Worry was an almost tougher opponent than the heavyweight boxers I fought. I realized that I had to learn to stop worrying, or worry would sap my vitality and undermine my success. So little by little, I worked out a system for myself. Now, here are some of the things I did. To keep up my courage in the ring, I'd give myself a pep talk during the fight. For example, while I was fighting Firpo, I kept saying over and over, "Nothing is going to stop me. He's not going to hurt me. I won't feel his blows. I can't get hurt. I'm going to keep going no matter what happens." Making positive statements like that to myself and thinking positive thoughts helped me a lot. It even kept my mind so occupied that I didn't feel the blows. During my career, I've had my lips smashed, my eyes cut, my ribs cracked. Firpo knocked me clear through the ropes, and I landed on a reporter's typewriter and wrecked it. But I never felt even one of Firpo's blows. There was only one blow that I ever really felt. That was the night Lester Johnson broke three of my ribs. The punch never hurt me, but it affected my breathing. Now, I can honestly say I never felt any other blow I ever got in the ring. Another thing I did was to keep reminding myself of the futility of worry. Most of my worrying was done before the big bouts while I was going through training. I'd often lie awake at night for hours, tossing and worrying, unable to sleep. I'd worry for fear I might break my hand or sprain my ankle or get my eye cut badly in the first round so I couldn't coordinate my punches. And when I got myself into this state of nerves, I used to get out of bed, look into the mirror, and give myself a good talking to. I'd say to myself, "What a fool you are to be worrying about something that hasn't happened and may never happen. Life is short. I have only a few years to live, so I must enjoy life." I kept saying to myself, "Nothing is important but my health. Nothing is important but my health." I kept reminding myself that losing sleep and worrying would destroy my health. I found that by saying these things to myself over and over, night after night, year after year, they finally got under my skin, and I could brush off my worries like so much water. The third and best thing I did was pray. And while I was training for a bout, I always prayed several times a day. When I was in the ring, I always prayed just before the bell sounded for each round. That helped me fight with courage and confidence. I've never gone to bed in my life without saying a prayer. I've never eaten a meal in my life without first thanking God for it, thousands of times. I Prayed to God to Keep Me Out of an Orphan's Home, by Kathleen Halter. As a little child, my life was filled with terror. My mother had heart trouble. Day after day, I saw her faint and fall to the floor. We all feared she was going to die, and I believe that all little girls whose mothers died were sent to the Central Wesleyan Orphan's Home, located in the little town of Warrenton, Missouri, where we lived. I dreaded the thought of going there, and when I was 6 years old, I prayed constantly, "Dear God, please let Mummy live until I am old enough not to go to the orphan's home." 20 years later, my brother, Minor, had a terrible injury and suffered intense pain until he died 2 years later. He couldn't feed himself or turn over in bed. To deaden his pain, I had to give him morphine hypodermics every 3 hours, day and night. I did this for 2 years. I was teaching music at the time at the Central Wesleyan College in Warrenton, Missouri. When the neighbors heard my brother screaming with pain, they would telephone me at the college, and I would leave my music class and rush home to give my brother another injection of morphine. Every night when I went to bed, I would set the alarm clock to go off 3 hours later, so I would be sure to get up to attend to my brother. I remember that on winter nights, I would keep a bottle of milk outside the window, where it would freeze and turn into a kind of ice cream that I loved to eat. When the alarm went off, this ice cream outside the window gave me an additional incentive to get up. In the midst of all these troubles, I did two things that kept me from indulging in self-pity and worrying and embittering my life with resentment. First, I kept myself busy teaching music from 12 to 14 hours a day, so I had little time to think of my troubles. And when I was tempted to feel sorry for myself, I kept saying to myself over and over, "Now listen, as long as you can walk and feed yourself and are free from intense pain, you ought to be the happiest person in the world. No matter what happens, never forget that as long as you live. Never, never." I was determined to do everything in my power to cultivate an unconscious and continuous attitude of gratefulness for my many blessings. Every morning when I awoke, I would thank God that I could get out of bed and walk to breakfast and feed myself. I fiercely resolved that in spite of my troubles, I would be the happiest person in Warrenton, Missouri. Maybe I didn't succeed in achieving that goal, but I did succeed in making myself the most grateful young woman in my hometown, and probably few of my associates worried less than I did. This Missouri music teacher applied two principles described in this book. She kept too busy to worry, and she counted her blessings. The same techniques may be helpful to you. My Stomach Was Twisting Like a Kansas Whirlwind by Cameron Shipp. I had been working very happily in the publicity department of Warner Brothers Studio in California for several years. I was a unit man and feature writer. I wrote stories for newspapers and magazines about Warner Brothers stars. Suddenly, I was promoted. I was made the assistant publicity director. As a matter of fact, there was a change of administrative policy, and I was given an impressive title, administrative assistant. This gave me an enormous office with a private refrigerator, two secretaries, and complete charge of a staff of 75 writers, exploiters, and radio men. I was enormously impressed. I went straight out and bought a new suit. I tried to speak with dignity. I set up filing systems, made decisions with authority, and ate quick lunches. I was convinced that the whole public relations policy of Warner Brothers had descended upon my shoulders. I perceived that the lives, both private and public, of such renowned persons as Betty Davis, Olivia de Havilland, James Cagney, Edward G. Robinson, Errol Flynn, Humphrey Bogart, Anne Sheridan, Alexis Smith, and Alan Hale were entirely in my hands. In less than a month, I became aware that I had stomach ulcers, probably cancer. My chief war activity at the time was as chairman of the War Activities Committee of the Screen Publicist Guild. I liked to do this work, liked to meet my friends at guild meetings, but these gatherings became matters of dread. After every meeting, I was violently ill. Often I had to stop my car on the way home, pulling myself together before I could drive on. There seemed to be so much to do, so little time in which to do it. It was all vital, and I was woefully inadequate. I'm being perfectly truthful. This was the most painful illness of my entire life. There was always a tight fist in my vitals. I lost weight. I could not sleep. The pain was constant. So I went to see a renowned expert in internal medicine. An advertising man recommended him. He said this physician had many clients who were advertising men. This physician spoke only briefly, just enough for me to tell him where I hurt and what I did for a living. He seemed more interested in my job than in my ailments, but I was soon reassured. For 2 weeks daily, he gave me every known test. I was probed, explored, x-rayed, and fluoroscoped. Finally, I was instructed to call on him and hear the verdict. "Mr. Shipp," he said, leaning back, "we've been through these exhaustive tests. They were absolutely necessary, although I knew, of course, after my first examination, that you did not have stomach ulcers. But I knew, because you're the kind of man you are, and because you do the kind of work you do, that you would not believe me unless I showed you. Let me show you." So he showed me the charts and the x-rays and explained them. He showed me I had no ulcers. "Now," said the doctor, "this cost you a good deal of money, but it is worth it to you. Here is the prescription. Don't worry." "Now," he stopped me as I started to expostulate, "now I realize you can't follow the prescription immediately, so I'll give you a crutch. Here are some pills. They contain belladonna. Take as many as you like. When you use these up, come back and I'll give you more. They won't hurt you, but they will always relax you. But remember, you don't need them. All you have to do is quit worrying. If you do start worrying again, you'll have to come back here and I'll charge you a heavy fee again. Now, how about it? I wish I could report the lesson took effect that day and that I quit worrying immediately. I didn't. I took the pills for several weeks. Whenever I felt a worry coming on, they worked. I felt better at once. But I felt silly taking these pills. I'm a big man physically. I'm almost as tall as Abe Lincoln was and weigh almost 200 pounds. Yet here I was taking little white pills to relax myself. When my friends asked me why I was taking pills, I was ashamed to tell the truth. Gradually, I began to laugh at myself. I said, "See here, Cameron Chip, you're acting like a fool. You are taking yourself and your little activities much, much too seriously. Betty Davis and James Cagney and Edward G. Robinson were world famous before you started to handle their publicity, and if you dropped dead tonight, Warner Brothers and their stars would manage to get along without you. Look at Eisenhower, General Marshall, MacArthur, Jimmy Doolittle, Admiral King. They're all running the war without taking pills. And yet you can't serve as chairman of the War Activities Committee of the Screen Publicist Guild without taking little white pills to keep your stomach from twisting and turning like a Kansas whirlwind." I began to take pride in getting along without the pills. A little while later, I threw the pills down the drain and got home each night in time to take a little nap before dinner, and gradually began to lead a normal life. I have never been back to see that physician. But I owe him much, much more than what seemed like a stiff fee at the time. He taught me to laugh at myself. But I think the really skillful thing he did was to refrain from laughing at me, and to refrain from telling me I had nothing to worry about. He took me seriously. He saved my face. He gave me an out in a small box. But he knew then, as well as I know now, that the cure wasn't in those silly little pills. The cure was in a change in my mental attitude. The moral of this story is that many a man who is now taking pills would do better to read Part 7 and relax. I Learned to Stop Worrying by Watching My Wife Wash Dishes by Reverend William Wood. A few years ago, I was suffering intensely from pains in my stomach. I would awaken two or three times each night, unable to sleep because of these terrific pains. I had watched my father die from cancer of the stomach, and I feared that I too had a stomach cancer, or at least stomach ulcers. So I went to a clinic for an examination. A renowned stomach specialist examined me with a fluoroscope. He gave me medicine to make me sleep and assured me I had no stomach ulcers or cancer. My pains, he said, were caused by emotional strains. Since I'm a minister, one of his first questions was, "Do you have an old crank on your church board?" He told me what I already knew. I was trying to do too much. In addition to my preaching every Sunday and carrying the burdens of the various activities of the church, I was also chairman of the Red Cross, president of Kiwanis. I also conducted two or three funerals each week and a number of other activities. I was working under constant pressure. I could never relax. I was always tense, hurried, and high-strung. I got to the point where I worried about everything. I was living in a constant dither. I was in such pain that I gladly acted on the doctor's advice. I took Monday off each week and began eliminating various responsibilities and activities. One day, while cleaning out my desk, I got an idea that proved to be immensely helpful. I was looking over an accumulation of old notes on sermons and other memos on matters that were now past and gone. I crumpled them up one by one and tossed them into a wastebasket. Suddenly I stopped and I said to myself, "Bill, why don't you do the same thing with your worries that you're doing with these notes? Why don't you crumple up your worries about yesterday's problems and toss them into the wastebasket?" And that one idea gave me immediate inspiration, gave me the feeling of a weight being lifted from my shoulders. From that day to this, I have made it a rule to throw into the wastebasket all the problems that I can no longer do anything about. Then one day, while wiping the dishes as my wife washed them, I got another idea. My wife was singing as she washed the dishes, and I said to myself, "Look, Bill, how happy your wife is. We've been married 18 years, and she's been washing dishes all that time. Suppose when we got married, she had looked ahead and seen all the dishes she would have to wash during those 18 years that stretched ahead. That pile of dirty dishes would be bigger than a barn. The very thought of it would have appalled any woman." And then I said to myself, "The reason my wife doesn't mind washing the dishes is because she washes only one day's dishes at a time." I saw what my problem was. I was trying to wash today's dishes and yesterday's dishes and dishes that weren't even dirty yet. I saw how foolish I was acting. I was standing in the pulpit Sunday mornings telling other people how to live, yet I myself was leading a tense, worried, hurried existence. I felt ashamed of myself. Now, worries don't bother me anymore. No more stomach pains, no more insomnia. I now crumple up yesterday's anxieties and toss them into the wastebasket, and I have ceased trying to wash tomorrow's dirty dishes today. Do you remember a statement quoted earlier in this book? "The load of tomorrow, added to that of yesterday, carried today, makes the strongest falter." Why even try it? I Found the Answer by Del Hughes. In 1943, I landed in a veterans hospital in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with 3 broken ribs and a punctured lung. Now, this happened during a practice marine amphibious landing off the Hawaiian Islands. I was getting ready to jump off the barge onto the beach when a big breaker swept in, lifted the barge, and threw me off balance and smashed me on the sands. I fell with such force that one of my ribs punctured my right lung. After spending 3 months in the hospital, I got the biggest shock of my life. The doctors told me that I showed absolutely no improvement. After some serious thinking, I figured that worry was preventing me from getting well. I'd been used to a very active life, and during these 3 months I'd been flat on my back 24 hours a day with nothing to do but think. The more I thought, the more I worried. Worried about whether I would ever be able to take my place in the world. Worried about whether I would remain a cripple the rest of my life, and about whether I would ever be able to get married and live a normal life. I urged my doctor to move me up to the next ward, which was called the Country Club, because the patients were allowed to do almost anything they cared to do. In this Country Club ward, I became interested in contract bridge. I spent 6 weeks learning the game, playing bridge with the other fellows, and reading Culbertson's books on bridge. After 6 weeks, I was playing nearly every evening for the rest of my stay in the hospital. I also became interested in painting with oils and studied this art under an instructor every afternoon from 3 to 5. Some of my paintings were so good you could almost tell what they were. I also tried my hand at soap and wood carving and read a number of books on the subject and found it fascinating. I kept myself so busy that I had no time to worry about my physical condition. I even found time to read books on psychology given to me by the Red Cross. At the end of 3 months, the entire medical staff came to me and congratulated me on making an amazing improvement. Those were the sweetest words I had ever heard since the day I was born. I wanted to shout with joy. Now, the point I'm trying to make is this. When I had nothing to do but lie on the flat of my back and worry about my future, I made no improvement whatever. I was poisoning my body with worry. Even the broken ribs wouldn't heal. But as soon as I got my mind off myself by playing contract bridge, painting oil pictures, and carving wood, the doctors declared I made an amazing improvement. I'm now leading a normal, healthy life, and my lungs are as good as yours. Now remember what George Bernard Shaw said. The secret of being miserable is to have the leisure to bother about whether you're happy or not. Keep active. Keep busy. Time Solves a Lot of Things by Louis T. Montant, Jr. Worry caused me to lose 10 years of my life. Those 10 years should have been the most fruitful and richest years of any young man's life, the years from 18 to 28. I realize now that losing those years was no one's fault but my own. I worried about everything, my job, my health, my family, my feelings of inferiority. I was so frightened that I used to cross the street to avoid meeting people I knew. When I met a friend on the street, I would often pretend not to notice him because I was afraid of being snubbed. I was so afraid of meeting strangers, so terrified in their presence, that in one space of 2 weeks I lost out on 3 different jobs simply because I didn't have the courage to tell those 3 prospective employers what I knew I could do. Then one day 8 years ago, I conquered worry in one afternoon and have rarely worried since then. That afternoon, I was in the office of a man who had far more troubles than I had ever faced, yet he was one of the most cheerful men I had ever known. He'd made a fortune in 1929 and then lost every cent. He made another fortune in 1933 and lost that, and another fortune in 1939 and lost that too. He had gone through bankruptcy and had been hounded by enemies and creditors. Troubles that would have broken some men and driven them to suicide rolled off him like water off a duck's back. As I sat in his office that day, 8 years ago, I envied him and wished that God had made me like him. As we were talking, he tossed a letter to me that he'd received that morning and said, "Read that." It was an angry letter, raising several embarrassing questions. If I'd received such a letter, it would have sent me into a tailspin. I said, "Bill, how are you going to answer it?" "Well," Bill said, "I'll tell you a little secret. Next time you've really got something to worry about, take a pencil on the piece of paper and sit down and write out in detail just what's worrying you. Then put that piece of paper in the lower right-hand drawer of your desk and wait a couple of weeks and then look at it. If what you wrote down still worries you when you read it, put that piece of paper back in your lower right-hand drawer. Let it sit there for another 2 weeks. It'll be safe there. Nothing will happen to it. But in the meantime, a lot may happen to the problem that is worrying you. I have found out that if I only have patience, the worry that's trying to harass me will often collapse like a pricked balloon." That bit of advice made a great impression on me. I've been using Bill's advice for years now, and as a result, I rarely worry about anything. Time solves a lot of things. Time may also solve what you're worrying about today. I Was Warned Not to Try to Speak or to Move Even a Finger, by Joseph L. Ryan. Several years ago, I was a witness in a lawsuit that caused me a great deal of mental strain and worry. After the case was over and I was returning home in the train, I had a sudden and violent physical collapse, heart trouble. I found it almost impossible to breathe. When I got home, the doctor gave me an injection. I wasn't in bed. I hadn't been able to get any further than the living room settee. And when I regained consciousness, I saw that the parish priest was already there to give me final absolution. I saw the stunned grief on the faces of my family. I knew my number was up. Later, I found out that the doctor had prepared my wife for the fact that I would probably be dead in less than 30 minutes. My heart was so weak I was warned not to try to speak or to move even a finger. I'd never been a saint, but I had learned one thing, and not to argue with God. So I closed my eyes and said, "Thy will be done. If it has to come now, thy will be done." As soon as I gave in to that thought, I seemed to relax all over. My terror disappeared, and I asked myself quietly, what was the worst that could happen now? Well, the worst seemed to be a possible return of the spasms with excruciating pains. Then all would be over. I would go to meet my Maker and soon be at peace. I lay on that settee and waited for an hour, but the pains didn't return. Finally, I began to ask myself what I would do with my life if I didn't die now. I determined that I would exert every effort to regain my health. I would stop abusing myself with tension and worry and rebuild my strength. And that was 4 years ago. I have rebuilt my strength to such a degree that even my doctor is amazed at the improvement my cardiograms show. I no longer worry. I have a new zest for life. But I can honestly say that if I hadn't faced the worst, my imminent death, and then tried to improve upon it, I don't believe I'd be here today. If I hadn't accepted the worst, I believe I would have died from my own fear and panic. And Mr. Ryan is alive today because he made use of the principle described in the magic formula: face the worst that can happen. I Am a Great Dismisser by Ordway Teed. Worry is a habit that I broke long ago. I believe that my habit of refraining from worrying is due largely to three things. First, I am too busy to indulge in self-destroying anxiety. I have three main activities, each one of which should be virtually a full-time job in itself. I lecture to large groups at Columbia University. I am also chairman of the Board of Higher Education of New York City. I also have charge of the Economic and Social Book Department of the publishing firm of Harper & Brothers. The insistent demands of these three tasks leave me no time to fret and stew and run around in circles. Second, I am a great dismisser. When I turn from one task to another, I dismiss all thoughts of the problems I have been thinking about previously. I find it stimulating and refreshing to turn from one activity to another. It rests me, it clears my mind. Third, I have had to school myself to dismiss all these problems from my mind when I close my office desk. They are always continuing. Each one always has a set of unsolved problems demanding my attention. If I carried these issues home with me each night and worried about them, I would destroy my health, and in addition, I would destroy all ability to cope with them. Ordway Teed is a master of the four good working habits. Do you remember what they are? See Part 7, Chapter 26. If I Had Not Stopped Worrying, I Would Have Been in My Grave Long Ago, by Connie Mack, the Grand Old Man of Baseball. I have been in professional baseball for over 63 years. When I first started back in the 80s, I got no salary at all. We played on vacant lots and stumbled over tin cans and discarded horse collars. When the game was over, we passed the hat. The pickings were pretty slim for me, especially since I was the main support of my widowed mother and my younger brothers and sisters. Sometimes the ball team would have to put on a strawberry supper or a clam bake to keep going. I've had plenty of reason to worry. I'm the only baseball manager who ever finished in last place for 7 consecutive years. I'm the only manager who ever lost 800 games in 8 years. After a series of defeats, I used to worry until I could hardly eat or sleep. But I stopped worrying 25 years ago, and I honestly believe that if I hadn't stopped worrying then, I would have been in my grave long ago. As I look back over my long life, I was born when Lincoln was president. I believe I was able to conquer worry by doing these things. 1, I saw how futile it was. I saw it was getting me nowhere and was threatening to wreck my career. 2, I saw it was going to ruin my health. 3, I kept myself so busy planning and working to win games in the future that I had no time to worry over games that were already lost. 4, I finally made it a rule never to call a player's attention to his mistakes until 24 hours after the game. In my early days, I used to dress and undress with the players. If the team had lost, I found it impossible to refrain from criticizing the players and from arguing with them bitterly over their defeats. I found this only increased my worries. Criticizing a player in front of the others didn't make him want to cooperate. It really made him bitter. So since I couldn't be sure of controlling myself and my tongue immediately after a defeat, I made it a rule never to see the players right after a defeat. I wouldn't discuss the defeat with them until the next day. By that time, I'd cooled off. The mistakes didn't loom so large, and I could talk things over calmly, and the men wouldn't get angry and try to defend themselves. 5, I tried to inspire players by building them up with praise instead of tearing them down with fault-finding. I tried to have a good word for everybody. 6, I found that I worried more when I was tired, so I spent 10 hours in bed every night, and I take a nap every afternoon. Even a 5-minute nap helps a lot. 7, I believe I've avoided worries and lengthened my life by continuing to be active. I'm 85, and I'm not going to retire until I begin telling the same stories over and over. When I start doing that, I'll know then that I'm growing old. Connie Mack never read a book on how to stop worrying, so he made out his own rules. Why don't you make a list of rules you've found helpful in the past and write them out right now? I got rid of stomach ulcers and worry by changing my job and my mental attitude. By Arden W. Sharp, Green Bay, Wisconsin. 5 years ago, I was worried, depressed, and sick. The doctor said I had stomach ulcers. They put me on a diet. I drank milk and ate eggs until I revolted at the sight of them, but I didn't get well. Then one day I read an article about cancer. I imagined I had every symptom. I was not worried now. I was terrified. Naturally, this made my stomach ulcers flare up like fire. The final blow came when the Army rejected me as physically unfit at 24. I was apparently a physical wreck when I should have been at the height of my physical powers. I was at the end of my rope. I couldn't see a ray of hope. In desperation, I tried to analyze how I'd gotten myself into this terrible condition. Slowly, the truth began to dawn on me. 2 years previously, I'd been happy and healthy in my work as a salesman, but wartime shortages had forced me to give up selling and take a job in a factory. I despised factory work, and to make matters worse, I was associating with a group of the most accomplished negative thinkers I'd ever had the misfortune to meet. They were bitter about everything. Nothing was right. They constantly condemned the job and cursed the pay, the hours, the boss, and everything. I realized that I had unconsciously absorbed their vindictive attitude. I slowly began to realize that my stomach ulcers were probably brought on by my own negative thoughts and bitter emotions. I then decided to go back to the work I liked, selling, and to associate with people who thought positive, constructive thoughts. This decision probably saved my life. I deliberately sought out friends and business associates who were progressive thinkers, happy, optimistic men free of worry and ulcers. As soon as I changed my emotions, I changed my stomach. Within a short time, I forgot that I had ever had ulcers. I soon found that you can catch health, happiness, and success from others just as easily as you can catch worries, bitterness, and failure. This is the most important lesson I have ever learned. I should have learned it long ago. I had heard about it and read about it dozens of times, but I had to learn it the hard way. I realize now what Jesus meant when he said, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." I Now Look for the Green Light by Joseph M. Cotter. From the time I was a small boy, throughout the early stages of young manhood and during my adult life, I was a professional worrier. My worries were many and varied. Some were real, most of them were imaginary. Upon rare occasions, I would find myself without anything to worry about. Then I would worry for fear I might be overlooking something. Then, 2 years ago, I started out on a new way of living. This required making a self-analysis of my faults and a very few virtues, a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. This brought out clearly what was causing all this worry. The fact was that I could not live for today alone. I was fretful of yesterday's mistakes and fearful of the future. I was told over and over that today was the tomorrow I had worried about yesterday, but it wouldn't work for me. I was advised to live on a 24-hour program. I was told that today was the only day over which I had any control, and that I should make the most of my opportunities each day. I was told that if I did that, I would be so busy I would have no time to worry about any other day, past or future. Now, that advice was logical, but somehow I found it hard to put these darned ideas to work for me. Then, like a shot out of the dark, I found the answer. And where do you suppose I found it? On a Northwestern Railroad platform at 7 p.m. May 31st, 1945. It was an important hour for me. That's why I remember it so clearly. We were taking some friends to the train. They were leaving on the city of Los Angeles, a streamliner, to return from a vacation. The war still on. Crowds were heavy that year. Instead of boarding the train with my wife, I wandered down the tracks toward the front of the train. I stood looking at the big, shiny engine for a minute. Presently, I looked down the track and saw a huge semaphore. An amber light was showing. Immediately, this light turned to a bright green. At that moment, the engineer started clanging a bell. I heard the familiar "all aboard," and in a matter of seconds, that huge streamliner began to move out of the station on its 2,300-mile trip. My mind started spinning. Something was trying to make sense to me. I was experiencing a miracle. Suddenly it dawned on me. That engineer had given me the answer I had been seeking. He was starting out on that long journey with only one green light to go by. If I'd been in his place, I would want to see all the green lights for the entire journey. Impossible, of course, yet that was exactly what I was trying to do with my life, sitting in the station, going no place, because I was trying too hard to see what was ahead for me. My thoughts kept coming. That engineer didn't worry about trouble that he might encounter miles ahead. There probably would be some delays, some slowdowns, but wasn't that why they had signal systems? Amber lights, reduce speed and take it easy. Red lights, real danger up ahead, stop. Now, that was what made train travel safe, a good signal system. I asked myself, why didn't I have a good signal system for my life? My answer was, I did have one. God had given it to me. He controls it, so it has to be foolproof. I started looking for a green light. Now, where could I find it? Well, if God created the green lights, why not ask Him? I did just that. And now, by praying each morning, I get my green light for that day. I also occasionally get amber lights that slow me down. Sometimes I get red lights that stop me before I crack up. No more worrying for me since that day 2 years ago when I made this discovery. During those 2 years, over 700 green lights have shone for me, and the trip through life is so much easier without the worry of what color the next light will be. No matter what color it may be, I will know what to do. How John D. Rockefeller lived on borrowed time for 45 years. John D. Rockefeller Sr. had accumulated his first million at the age of 33. At the age of 43, he'd built up the largest monopoly the world has ever seen, the great Standard Oil Company. But where was he at 53? A worry had gotten him at 53. Worry and high-tension living had already wrecked his health. At 53, he looked like a mummy, says John K. Winkler, one of his biographers. At 53, Rockefeller was attacked by mystifying digestive maladies that swept away his hair, even the eyelashes, and all but a faint wisp of eyebrow. So serious was his condition, says Winkler, that at one time John D. was compelled to exist on human milk. According to the doctors, he had alopecia, a form of baldness that often starts with sheer nerves. He looked so startling with his stark, bald dome that he had to wear a skull cap. Later, he had wigs made at $500 apiece for the rest of his life. He wore those silver wigs. Rockefeller had originally been blessed with an iron constitution. Reared on a farm, he had once had stalwart shoulders, an erect carriage, a strong, brisk gait. Yet at only 53, when most men are at their prime, his shoulders drooped and he shambled when he walked. When he looked in a glass, says John T. Flynn, another of his biographers, he saw an old man. The ceaseless work, the endless worry, the streams of abuse, the sleepless nights, and the lack of exercise and rest had exacted their toll. They had brought him to his knees. He was now the richest man in the world. Yet he had to live on a diet that a pauper would have scorned. His income at the time was $1 million a week, but $2 a week would probably have paid for all the food he could eat. Acidulated milk and a few crackers were all the doctors would allow him. His skin had lost its color. It looked like old parchment drawn tight across his bones. And nothing but medical care, the best money could buy, kept him from dying at the age of 53. How did it happen? Worry. Shock. High pressure and high-tension living. He drove himself literally to the edge of the grave. Even at the age of 23, Rockefeller was already pursuing his goal with such grim determination that, according to those who knew him, nothing lightened his countenance save news of a good bargain. When he made a big profit, he would do a little war dance, throw his hat on the floor, and break into a jig. But if he lost money, he was ill. He once shipped $40,000 worth of grain by way of the Great Lakes. No insurance. It cost too much. $150. That night, a vicious storm raged over Lake Erie. Rockefeller was so worried about losing his cargo that when his partner, George Gardner, reached the office in the morning, he found John D. there pacing the floor. "Hurry," he quavered. "Let's see if we can take out insurance now, if it isn't too late." Gardner rushed uptown and got the insurance, but when he returned to the office, he found John D. in an even worse state of nerves. A telegram had arrived in the meantime. The cargo had landed, safe from the storm. He was sicker than ever now because they had wasted the $150. In fact, he was so sick about it that he had to go home and take to his bed. Think of it. At that time, his firm was doing a gross business of $500,000 a year, yet he made himself so ill over $150 that he had to go to bed. He had no time for play, no time for recreation, no time for anything except making money and teaching Sunday school. When his partner, George Gardner, purchased a second-hand yacht with three other men for $2,000, John D. was aghast, refused to go out on it. Gardner found him working at the office one Saturday afternoon and pleaded, "Come on, John, let's go for a sail. It will do you good. Forget about business. Have a little fun." Rockefeller glared. "George Gardner," he warned, "you are the most extravagant man I ever knew. You are injuring your credit at the banks, and my credit, too. First thing you know, you'll be wrecking our business. No, I won't go on your yacht. I don't ever want to see it." And he stayed plugging in the office all Saturday afternoon. The same lack of humor, the same lack of perspective characterized John D. all through his business career. Years later, he said, "I never placed my head upon the pillow at night without reminding myself that my success might be only temporary." With millions at his command, he never put his head upon his pillow without worrying about losing his fortune. No wonder worry wrecked his health. He had no time for play or recreation, never went to the theater, never played cards, never went to a party. As Mark Hanna said, the man was mad about money. Sane in every other respect, but mad about money. Rockefeller had once confessed to a neighbor in Cleveland, Ohio, that he wanted to be loved. Yet he was so cold and suspicious that few people even liked him. Morgan once balked at having to do business with him at all. "I don't like the man," he snorted. "I don't want to have any dealings with him." Rockefeller's own brother hated him so much that he removed his children's bodies from the family plot. "No one of my blood," he said, "will ever rest in land controlled by John D." Rockefeller's employees and associates lived in holy fear of him. And here's the ironic part. He was afraid of them, afraid they would talk outside of the office and give secrets away. He had so little faith in human nature that once when he signed a 10-year contract with an independent refiner, he made the man promise not to tell anyone, not even his wife. "Shut your mouth and run your business," and that was his motto. Then, at the very peak of his prosperity, with gold flowing into his coffers like hot yellow lava pouring down the sides of Vesuvius, his private world collapsed. Books and articles denounced the robber baron war of Standard Oil Company, secret rebates with railroads, the ruthless crushing of all rivals. In the oil fields of Pennsylvania, John D. Rockefeller was the most hated man on earth. He was hanged in effigy by the men he had crushed. Many of them longed to tie a rope around his withered neck and hang him to the limb of a sour apple tree. Letters breathing fire and brimstone poured into his office, letters threatening his life. He hired bodyguards to keep his enemies from killing him. He attempted to ignore this cyclone of hate. He had once said cynically, "You may kick me and abuse me, provided you will let me have my own way." But he discovered he was human after all. He couldn't take hate and worry, too. His health began to crack. He was puzzled and bewildered by this new enemy, illness, which attacked him from within. At first, he remained secretive about his occasional indispositions, tried to put his illness out of his mind. But insomnia, indigestion, and the loss of his hair, all physical symptoms of worry and collapse, were not to be denied. Finally, his doctors told him the shocking truth. He could take his choice, his money and his worries, or his life. They warned him he must either retire or die. He retired. But before he retired, worry, greed, fear had already wrecked his health. When Ida Tarbell, America's most celebrated female writer of biographies, saw him, she was shocked. She wrote, "An awful age was in his face. He was the oldest man I have ever seen." Old? Why, Rockefeller was then several years younger than General MacArthur was when he recaptured the Philippines. But he was such a physical wreck that Ida Tarbell pitied him. She was working at that time on her powerful book, which condemned the Standard Oil and all that it stood for. She certainly had no cause to love the man who had built up this octopus. Yet she said that when she saw John D. Rockefeller teaching a Sunday school class, eagerly searching the faces of all those around him, "I had a feeling which I had not expected, and which time intensified. I was sorry for him. I know no companion so terrible as fear." When the doctors undertook to save Rockefeller's life, they gave him three rules which he observed to the letter for the rest of his life. Here they are. 1. Avoid worry. Never worry about anything, under any kind of circumstances. 2. Relax and take plenty of mild exercise in the open air. 3. Watch your diet. Always stop eating while you're still a little hungry. John D. Rockefeller obeyed those rules, and they probably saved his life. He retired. He learned to play golf. He went in for gardening. He chatted with his neighbors, he played games, he sang songs. But he did something else, too. During the days of torture and nights of insomnia, says Winkler, John D. had time for reflection. He began to think of other people. He stopped thinking, for once, of how much money he could get, and he began to wonder how much that money would buy in terms of human happiness. In short, Rockefeller now began to give his millions away. Some of the time, it wasn't easy. When he offered money to a church, pulpits all over the country thundered back with cries of tainted money. But he kept on giving. He learned of a starving little college on the shores of Lake Michigan that was being foreclosed because of its mortgage. He came to its rescue and poured millions of dollars into that college and built it into the now world-famous University of Chicago. He tried to help the Negroes. He gave money to Negro universities like Tuskegee College, where funds were needed to carry on the work of George Washington Carver. He helped to fight hookworm. When Dr. Charles W. Stiles, the hookworm authority, said 50 cents worth of medicine will cure a man of this disease which ravages the South, but who will give the 50 cents, Rockefeller gave it. He spent millions on hookworm, stamping out the greatest scourge that ever handicapped the South. And then he went further. He established a great international foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, which was to fight disease and ignorance all over the world. I speak with feeling of this work, for I probably owe my life to the Rockefeller Foundation. How well I remember that when I was in China in 1932, cholera was raging all over Peking. The Chinese peasants were dying like flies. Yet in the midst of all this horror, we were able to go to the Rockefeller Medical College and get a vaccination to protect us from the plague. Chinese and foreigners alike, we were able to do that. And that was when I got my first understanding of what Rockefeller's millions were doing for the world. Never before in history has there ever been anything remotely like the Rockefeller Foundation. It's something unique. Rockefeller knew that all over the world there are many fine movements that men of vision start. Research is undertaken, colleges are founded, doctors struggle on to fight a disease, but only too often this high-minded work has to die for lack of funds. he decided to help these pioneers of humanity, not to take them over, but to give them some money and help them help themselves. Today, you and I can thank John D. Rockefeller for the miracles of penicillin and for dozens of other discoveries which his money helped to finance. You can thank him for the fact that your children no longer die from spinal meningitis, a disease that used to kill 4 out of 5. And you can thank him for part of the inroads we have made on malaria and tuberculosis, on influenza and diphtheria, and many other diseases that still plague the world. And what about Rockefeller? When he gave his money away, did he gain peace of mind? Yes, he was contented at last. If the public thought of him after 1900 as brooding over the attacks on Standard Oil, said Alan Nevins, the public was much mistaken. Rockefeller was happy. He had changed so completely that he didn't worry at all. In fact, he refused even to lose one night's sleep when he was forced to accept the greatest defeat of his career. The defeat came when the corporation he had built, the huge Standard Oil, was ordered to pay the heaviest fine in history. According to the United States government, the Standard Oil was a monopoly in direct violation of the antitrust laws. The battle raged for 5 years. The best legal brains in the land fought on interminably in what was up to then the longest court war in history. But Standard Oil lost. When Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis handed down his decision, lawyers for the defense feared that old John D. would take it very hard. But they didn't know how much he'd changed. That night, one of the lawyers got John D. on the phone. He discussed the decision as gently as he could and then said, with concern, "I hope you won't let this decision upset you, Mr. Rockefeller. I hope you'll be able to get a good night's sleep." And old John D., why, he cackled right back across the wire, "Don't worry, Mr. Johnson. I intend to get a night's sleep, and don't let it bother you either. Good night." And that, from the man who had once taken to his bed because he had lost $150. Yes, it took a long time for John D. to conquer worry. He was dying at 53, but he lived to 98. I Was Committing Slow Suicide Because I Didn't Know How to Relax, by Paul Sampson. Up to 6 months ago, I was rushing through life in high gear. I was always tense, never relaxed. I arrived at home from work every night worried and exhausted from nervous fatigue. Why? Because no one ever said to me, "Paul, you're killing yourself. Why don't you slow down? Why don't you relax?" I would get up fast in the morning, eat fast, shave fast, dress fast, and drive to work as if I were afraid the steering wheel would fly out the window if I didn't have a death grip on it. I worked fast, hurried home, and at night I even tried to sleep fast. I was in such a state that I went to see a famous nerve specialist in Detroit. He told me to relax. He told me to think of relaxing all the time, to think about it when I was working, driving, eating, and trying to go to sleep. He told me that I was committing slow suicide because I didn't know how to relax. Ever since then, I've practiced relaxation. When I go to bed at night, I don't try to go to sleep until I've consciously relaxed my body and my breathing. And now I wake up in the morning rested, a big improvement, because I used to wake up in the morning tired and tense. I relax now when I eat and when I drive. To be sure, I'm alert when driving, but I drive with my mind now instead of my nerves. The most important place I relax is at my work. Several times a day, I stop everything and take inventory of myself to see if I'm entirely relaxed. When the phone rings now, no longer do I grab it as though someone were trying to beat me to it, and when someone is talking to me, I am as relaxed as a sleeping baby. The result? Life is much more pleasant and enjoyable, and I'm completely free of nervous fatigue and nervous worry. A Real Miracle Happened to Me, by Mrs. John Berger. Worry had completely defeated me. My mind was so confused and troubled that I could see no joy in living. My nerves were so strained that I could neither sleep at night nor relax by day. My 3 young children were widely separated, living with relatives. My husband, having recently returned from the armed service, was in another city trying to establish a law practice. I felt all the insecurities and uncertainties of the post-war readjustment period. I was threatening my husband's career, my children's natural endowment of a happy, normal home life, and I was also threatening my own life. My husband could find no housing, and the only solution was to build. Everything depended on my getting well. The more I realized this, and the harder I would try, the greater would be my fear of failure. Then I developed a fear of planning for any responsibility. I felt that I could no longer trust myself. I felt I was a complete failure. When all was darkest, and there seemed to be no help, my mother did something for me that I shall never forget or cease being grateful for. She shocked me into fighting back. She upbraided me for giving in and for losing control of my nerves and my mind. She challenged me to get up out of bed and fight for all I had. She said I was giving in to the situation, fearing it instead of facing it, running away from life instead of living it. So I did start fighting from that day on. That very weekend, I told my parents they could go home because I was going to take over, and I did what seemed impossible at the time. I was left alone to care for my two younger children. I slept well, I began to eat better, and my spirits began to improve. A week later, when they returned to visit me again, they found me singing at my ironing. I had a sense of well-being because I'd begun to fight a battle and I was winning. I shall never forget this lesson. If a situation seems insurmountable, face it. Start fighting. Don't give in. From that time on, I forced myself to work and lost myself in my work. Finally, I gathered my children together and joined my husband in our new home. I resolved that I would become well enough to give my lovely family a strong, happy mother. I became engrossed with plans for our home, plans for my children, plans for my husband, plans for everything except for me. I became too busy to think of myself, and it was then that the real miracle happened. I grew stronger and stronger and could wake up with the joy of well-being, the joy of planning for the new day ahead, the joy of living. And although days of depression did creep in occasionally after that, especially when I was tired, I would tell myself not to think or try to reason with myself on those days, and gradually they became fewer and fewer and finally disappeared. Now, a year later, I have a very happy, successful husband, a beautiful home that I can work in 16 hours a day, and three healthy, happy children, and for myself, peace of mind. How Benjamin Franklin Conquered Worry. A letter from Benjamin Franklin to Joseph Priestley. The latter, invited to become librarian for the Earl of Shelburne, asked Franklin's advice. Franklin, in his letter, states his method of solving problems without worrying. London, September 19, 1772. Dear Sir, in the affair of so much importance to you wherein you ask my advice, I cannot, for want of sufficient premise, advise you what to determine, but if you please, I will tell you how. When these difficult cases occur, they are difficult chiefly because while we have them under consideration, all the reasons pro and con are not present to the mind at the same time, but sometimes one set present themselves, and at other times another, the first being out of sight. Hence the various purposes or inclinations that alternately prevail, and the uncertainty that perplexes us. To get over this, my way is to divide half a sheet of paper by a line into two columns, writing over the one pro and over the other con. Then, during 3 or 4 days' consideration, I put down under the different heads short hints of the different motives that at different times occur to me, for or against the measure. When I have thus got them all together in one view, I endeavor to estimate their respective weights, and where I find two, one on each side, that seem equal, I strike them both out. If I find a reason pro equal to some two reasons con, I can strike out the three. If I judge some two reasons con equal to some three reasons pro, I strike out the five, and thus proceeding I find at length where the balance lies. And if, after a day or two of further consideration, nothing new that is of importance occurs on either side, I come to a determination accordingly. And though the weight of reasons cannot be taken with the precision of algebraic quantities, yet when each is thus considered separately and comparatively, and the whole lies before me, I think I can judge better, and am less likely to make a rash step, and in fact I have found great advantage from this kind of equation in what may be called moral or prudential algebra. Wishing sincerely that you may determine for the best, I am ever, my dear friend, yours most affectionately, Ben Franklin. I was so worried I didn't eat a bite of solid food for 18 days, by Catherine Holcomb Farmer. 3 months ago I was so worried that I didn't sleep for 4 days and nights, and did not eat a bite of solid food for 18 days. Even the smell of food made me violently sick. I cannot find words to describe the mental anguish I endured. I wonder whether hell has any worse tortures than what I went through. I felt as if I would go insane or die. I knew that I couldn't possibly continue living as I was. The turning point of my life was the day I was given an advanced copy of this book. During the last 3 months, I have practically lived with this book, studying every page, desperately trying to find a new way of life. The change that has occurred in my mental outlook and emotional stability is almost unbelievable. I am now able to endure the battles of each passing day. I now realize that in the past I was being driven half mad, not by today's problems, but by the bitterness and anxiety over something that had happened yesterday, or that I feared might happen tomorrow. But now, when I find myself starting to worry about anything, I immediately stop and start to apply some of the principles I learned from studying this book. If I am tempted to tense up over something that must be done today, I get busy and do it immediately and get it off my mind. When I'm faced with the kind of problems that used to drive me half crazy, I now calmly set about trying to apply the 3 steps outlined in Chapter 2, Part 1. First, I ask myself, what is the worst that can possibly happen? Second, I try to accept it mentally. Third, I concentrate on the problem and see how I can improve the worst, which I'm already willing to accept if I have to. When I find myself worrying about a thing I cannot change and do not want to accept, I stop myself short and repeat this little prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Since reading this book, I'm really experiencing a new and glorious way of life. I am no longer destroying my health and happiness by anxiety. I can sleep 9 hours a night now. I enjoy my food. A veil has been lifted from me. A door has been opened. I can now see and enjoy the beauty of the world which surrounds me. I thank God for life now and for the privilege of living in such a wonderful world. May I suggest that you also read this book over, keep it by your bed, underscore the parts that apply to your problems, study it, use it. For this is not a reading book in the ordinary sense. It is written as a guidebook to a new way of life.